though the shape of the strange letters never altered, they found that they could understand them. If only Diggory had remembered what he himself had said a few minutes ago, that this was an enchanted room, he might have guessed that the enchantment was beginning to work. But he was too wild with curiosity to think about that. He was longing more and more to know what was written on the pillar, and very soon they both knew. What it said was something like this. At least this is the sense of it, though the poetry, when you read it there, was better. Make your choice, adventurous stranger. Strike the bell and bide the danger, or wonder till it drives you mad what would have followed if you had.
No fear, said Polly. We don't want any danger.
Oh, but don't you see it's no good, said Diggory. We can't get out of it now. We shall always be wondering what would have happened if we'd struck the bell.
I'm not going home to be driven mad by always thinking of that. No fear.
Don't be so silly, said Polly, as if anyone would. What does it matter what would have happened?
I expect anyone who's come as far as this is bound to go on wondering till it sends him dotty. That's the magic of it, you see. I can feel it beginning to work on me already.
Well, I don't, said Polly crossly, and I don't believe you do either. You're just putting it on.
That's all you know, said Diggory. It's because you're a girl. Girls never want to know anything but gossip and rot about people getting engaged.
You looked exactly like your uncle when you said that, said Polly.
Why can't you keep to the point, said Diggory? What we're talking about is...
How exactly like a man,
said Polly in a very grown-up voice, but she added hastily in her real voice,
and don't say I'm just like a woman, or you'll be a beastly copycat.
I should never dream of calling a kid like you a woman, said Diggory loftily.
Oh, I'm a kid, am I? Said Polly, who was now in a real rage. Well, you needn't be bothered by having a kid with you any longer, then. I'm off. I've had enough of this place, and I've had enough of you too. You beastly, stuck-up, obstinate pig!
None of that, said Diggory, in a voice even nastier than he meant it to be, for he saw Polly's hand moving to her pocket to get hold of her yellow ring. I can't excuse what he did next, except by saying that he was very sorry for it afterward, and so were a good many other people. Before Polly's hand reached her pocket, he grabbed her wrist, leaning across her with his back against her chest. Then, keeping her other arm out of the way with his other elbow, he leaned forward, picked up the hammer, and struck the golden bell, a light, smart tap. Then he let her go, and they fell apart, staring at each other and breathing hard. Polly was just beginning to cry, not with fear, and not even because he'd hurt her wrist quite fairly badly, but with furious anger. Within 2 seconds, however, they had something to think about that drove their own quarrels quite out of their minds. As soon as the bell was struck, it gave out a note, a sweet note such as you might have expected, and not very loud. But instead of dying away again, it went on, and as it went on, it grew louder. Before a minute had passed, it was twice as loud as it had been to begin with. It was soon so loud that if the children had tried to speak, but they weren't thinking of speaking now, they were just standing there with their mouths open, they would not have heard one another. Very soon it was so loud that they could not have heard one another even by shouting. And still it grew, all on one note, a continuous sweet sound, though the sweetness had something horrible about it, till all the air in that great room was throbbing with it, and they could feel the stone floor trembling under their feet. Then at last it began to be mixed with another sound, a vague, disastrous noise, which sounded first like the roar of a distant train, and then like the crash of a falling tree. They heard something like great weights falling. Finally, with a sudden rush and thunder and a shake that nearly flung them off their feet, about a quarter of the roof at one end of the room fell in. Great blocks of masonry fell all around them, and the walls rocked. The noise of the bell stopped. The clouds of dust cleared away. Everything became quiet again. It was never found out whether the fall of the roof was due to magic, or whether that unbearably loud sound from the bell just happened to strike the note which was more than those crumbling walls could stand.
There, I hope you're satisfied now, panted Polly.
Well, it's all over anyway, said Diggory. And both thought it was. But they had never been more mistaken in their lives.
Chapter 5. The Deplorable Word. The children were facing one another across the pillar where the bell hung, still trembling, though it no longer gave out any note. Suddenly, they heard a soft noise from the end of the room, which was still undamaged. They turned quick as lightning to see what it was. One of the robed figures, the furthest off one of all, the woman whom Diggory thought so beautiful, was rising from her chair. When she stood up, they realized that she was even taller than they had thought, and you could see at once not only from her crown and robes, but from the flash of her eyes and the curve of her lips, that she was a great queen. She looked round the room and saw the damage and saw the children, but you could not guess from her face what she thought of either, or whether she was surprised. She came forward with long, swift strides.
"Who has awaked me? Who has broken the spell?" she asked.
"I think it must have been me," said Diggory.
"You,"
said the Queen, laying her hand on his shoulder, a white, beautiful hand, but Diggory could feel that it was strong as steel pincers.
"You, but you are only a child, a common child. Anyone can see at a glance that you have no drop of royal or noble blood in your veins. How did such as you dare to enter this house?"
"We've come from another world, by magic," said Polly,
who thought it was high time the Queen took some notice of her as well as of Diggory.
"Is this true?"
said the Queen, still looking at Diggory and not giving Polly even a glance.
"Yes, it is," said he. The Queen put her other hand under his chin and forced it up, so that she could see his face better.
Diggory tried to stare back, but he soon had to let his eyes drop. There was something about hers that overpowered him. After she had studied him for well over a minute, she let go of his chin and said,
"You are no magician. The mark of it is not on you. You must be only the servant of a magician. It is on another's magic that you have travelled here."
"It was my Uncle Andrew," said Diggory. At the moment, not in the room itself, but from somewhere very close, there came first a rumbling, then a creaking, and then a roar of falling masonry, and the floor shook.
"There is great peril here," said the Queen. "The whole palace is breaking up. If we are not out in a few minutes, we shall be buried under the ruin."
She spoke as calmly as if she had been merely mentioning the time of day.
"Come,"
she added, and held out a hand to each of the children. Polly, who was disliking the Queen and feeling sulky, would not have let her hand be taken if she could have helped it, but though the Queen spoke so calmly, her movements were as quick as thought. Before Polly knew what was happening, her left hand had been caught in a hand so much longer and stronger than her own that she could do nothing about it.
"This is a terrible woman," thought Polly. "She's strong enough to break my arm with one twist. And now that she's got my left hand, I can't get at my yellow ring. If I tried to stretch across and get my right hand into my left pocket, I mightn't be able to reach it before she asked me what I was doing. Whatever happens, we mustn't let her know about the rings. I do hope Diggory has the sense to keep his mouth shut. I wish I could get a word with him alone."
The Queen led them out of the Hall of Images, into a long corridor, and then through a whole maze of halls and stairs and courtyards. Again and again they heard parts of the great palace collapsing, sometimes quite close to them. Once a huge arch came thundering down only a moment after they had passed through it. The Queen was walking quickly. The children had to trot to keep up with her, but she showed no sign of fear. Diggory thought, "She's wonderfully brave and strong. She's what I call a queen. I do hope she's going to tell us the story of this place." She did tell them certain things as they went along.
"That is the door to the dungeons," she would say, or, "That passage leads to the principal torture chambers," or, "This was the old banqueting hall where my great-grandfather bade 700 nobles to a feast and killed them all before they had drunk their fill. They had had rebellious thoughts."
They came at last into a hall larger and loftier than any they had yet seen. From its size, and from the great doors at the far end, Diggory thought that now at last they must be coming to the main entrance. In this he was quite right. The doors were dead black, either ebony or some black metal which is not found in our world. They were fastened with great bars, most of them too high to reach and all too heavy to lift. He wondered how they would get out. The Queen let go of his hand and raised her arm. She drew herself up to her full height and stood rigid. Then she said something which they couldn't understand, but it sounded horrid, and made an action as if she were throwing something toward the doors. And those high and heavy doors trembled for a second as if they were made of silk, and then crumbled away till there was nothing left of them but a heap of dust on the threshold. "Phew!" whistled Diggory.
"Has your master magician, your uncle, power like mine?" asked the Queen, firmly seizing Diggory's hand again. "But I shall know later. In the meantime, remember what you have seen. This is what happens to things and to people who stand in my way."
Much more light than they had yet seen in that country was pouring in through the now empty doorway, and when the Queen led them out through it, they were not surprised to find themselves in the open air. The wind that blew in their faces was cold, yet somehow stale. They were looking from a high terrace, and there was a great landscape spread out below them. Low down and near the horizon hung a great red sun, far bigger than our sun. Diggory felt at once that it was also older than ours, a sun near the end of its life, weary of looking down upon that world. To the left of the sun and higher up there was a single star, big and bright. Those were the only two things to be seen in the dark sky. They made a dismal group. And on the earth, in every direction as far as the eye could reach, there spread a vast city in which there was no living thing to be seen. And all the temples, towers, palaces, pyramids, and bridges cast long, disastrous-looking shadows in the light of that withered sun. Once a great river had flowed through the city, but the water had long since vanished, and it was now only a wide ditch of grey dust.
"Look well on that which no eyes will ever see again," said the Queen. "Such was Chan, that great city, the city of the King of Kings, the wonder of the world, perhaps of all worlds. Does your uncle rule any city as great as this, boy?"
"No," said Diggory. He was going to explain that Uncle Andrew didn't rule any cities, but the Queen went on.
"It is silent now, but I have stood here when the whole air was full of the noises of Chan, the trampling of feet, the creaking of wheels, the cracking of the whips and the groaning of slaves, the thunder of chariots and the sacrificial drums beating in the temples. I have stood here, but that was near the end, when the roar of battle went up from every street and the river of Chan ran red." She paused and added, "All in one moment, one woman blotted it out forever."
"Who?" said Diggory in a faint voice, but he had already guessed the answer.
"I," said the Queen. "I, Jadis, the last queen, but the queen of the world."
The two children stood silent, shivering in the cold wind.
"It was my sister's fault," said the Queen. "She drove me to it. May the curse of all the powers rest upon her forever. At any moment I was ready to make peace, yes, and to spare her life too, if only she would yield me the throne. But she would not. Her pride has destroyed the whole world. Even after the war had begun, there was a solemn promise that neither side would use magic. But when she broke her promise, what could I do? Fool! As if she did not know that I had more magic than she. She even knew that I had the secret of the deplorable word. Did she think, she was always a weakling, that I would not use it?"
"What was it?" said Diggory.
"That was the secret of secrets," said Queen Jadis. "It had long been known to the great kings of our race that there was a word which, if spoken with the proper ceremonies, would destroy all living things except the one who spoke it. But the ancient kings were weak and soft-hearted, and bound themselves and all who should come after them with great oaths never even to seek after the knowledge of that word. But I learnt it in a secret place, and paid a terrible price to learn it. I did not use it until she forced me to it. I fought and fought to overcome her by every other means. I poured out the blood of my armies like water."
"Beast," muttered Polly.
The last great battle, said the Queen, raged for 3 days here in Charn itself. For 3 days I looked down upon it from this very spot. I did not use my power till the last of my soldiers had fallen, and the accursed woman, my sister, at the head of her rebels was halfway up those great stairs that lead up from the city to the terrace. Then I waited till we were so close that we could see one another's faces. She flashed her horrible wicked eyes upon me and said, "Victory!" "Yes," said I, "victory, but not yours." Then I spoke the deplorable word. A moment later, I was the only living thing beneath the sun.
"But the people," gasped Diggory.
"What people, boy?" asked the Queen.
"All the ordinary people," said Polly, "who'd never done you any harm, and the women and the children and the animals."
"Don't you understand?" said the Queen, still speaking to Diggory. "I was the Queen. They were all my people. What else were they there for but to do my will?"
"It was rather hard luck on them all the same," said he.
"I had forgotten that you were only a common boy. How should you understand reasons of state? You must learn, child, that what would be wrong for you or any of the common people is not wrong in a great queen such as I. The weight of the world is on our shoulders. We must be freed from all rules. Ours is a high and lonely destiny."
Diggory suddenly remembered that Uncle Andrew had used exactly the same words, but they sounded much grander when Queen Jadis said them, perhaps because Uncle Andrew was not 7 feet tall and dazzlingly beautiful.
"And what did you do then?" said Diggory.
"I had already cast strong spells on the hall where the images of my ancestors sit. And the force of those spells was that I should sleep among them, like an image myself, and need neither food nor fire, though it were 1,000 years till one came and struck the bell and awoke me."
"Was it the deplorable word that made the sun like that?" asked Diggory.
"Like what?" said Jadis.
"So big, so red, and so cold."
"It has always been so," said Jadis, "at least for hundreds of thousands of years. Have you a different sort of sun in your world?"
"Yes, it's smaller and yellower, and it gives a good deal more heat."
The Queen gave a long-drawn, "Ah-ha-ha-ha," and Diggory saw on her face that same hungry and greedy look which he had lately seen on Uncle Andrew's. "So," she said, "yours is a younger world."
She paused for a moment to look once more at the deserted city. And if she was sorry for all the evil she had done, she certainly didn't show it, and then said,
"Now, let us be going. It is cold here at the end of all the ages."
"Going where?" asked both the children.
"Where?" repeated Jadis in surprise. "To your world, of course."
Polly and Diggory looked at each other aghast. Polly had disliked the Queen from the first. And even Diggory, now that he had heard the story, felt that he had seen quite as much of her as he wanted. Certainly she was not at all the sort of person one would like to take home, and if they did like, they didn't know how they could. What they wanted was to get away themselves, but Polly couldn't get at her ring, and of course Diggory couldn't go without her. Diggory got very red in the face and stammered,
"Our world, I didn't know you wanted to go there." "What else were you sent for if not to fetch me?" asked Jadis.
"I'm sure you wouldn't like our world at all," said Diggory. "It's not her sort of place, is it, Polly? It's very dull, not worth seeing, really."
"It will soon be worth seeing when I rule it," answered the Queen.
"Oh, but you can't," said Diggory. "It's not like that. They wouldn't let you, you know."
The Queen gave a contemptuous smile. "Many great kings," she said, "thought they could stand against the House of Charn, but they all fell, and their very names are forgotten."
"Foolish boy! Do you think that I, with my beauty and my magic, will not have your whole world at my feet before a year has passed? Prepare your incantations and take me there at once."
"This is perfectly frightful," said Diggory to Polly.
"Perhaps you fear for this uncle of yours," said Jadis. "But if he honours me duly, he shall keep his life and his throne. I am not coming to fight against him. He must be a very great magician if he has found how to send you here. Is he king of your whole world, or only of part?"
"He isn't king of anywhere," said Diggory.
"You are lying," said the Queen. "Does not magic always go with the royal blood? Whoever heard of common people being magicians? I can see the truth whether you speak it or not. Your uncle is the great king and the great enchanter of your world, and by his art he has seen the shadow of my face in some magic mirror or some enchanted pool, and for the love of my beauty he has made a potent spell which shook your world to its foundations and sent you across the vast gulf between world and world to ask my favor and to bring me to him. Answer me. Is that not how it was?
Well, not exactly, said Diggory.
Not exactly, shouted Polly. Why, it's absolute bosh from beginning to end.
Minion,
cried the Queen, turning in rage upon Polly and seizing her hair at the very top of her head where it hurts most. But in so doing she let go of both the children's hands. Now, shouted Diggory, and quick, shouted Polly. They plunged their left hands into their pockets. They did not even need to put the rings on. The moment they touched them, the whole of that dreary world vanished from their eyes. They were rushing upward, and a warm green light was growing nearer overhead.
Chapter 6. The Beginning of Uncle Andrew's Troubles.
"Let go! Let go!" screamed Polly. "I'm not touching you," said Diggory. Then their heads came out of the pool, and once more the sunny quietness of the wood between the worlds was all about them, and it seemed richer and warmer and more peaceful than ever after the staleness and ruin of the place they had just left. I think that if they'd been given the chance, they would again have forgotten who they were and where they came from, and would have lain down and enjoyed themselves half asleep, listening to the growing of the trees. But this time there was something that kept them as wide awake as possible. For as soon as they had got out onto the grass, they found that they were not alone. The queen, or the witch, whichever you like to call her, had come up with them, holding on fast by Polly's hair. That was why Polly had been shouting out, "Let go!" This proved, by the way, another thing about the rings which Uncle Andrew hadn't told Diggory, because he didn't know it himself. In order to jump from world to world by using one of those rings, you don't need to be wearing or touching it yourself. It is enough if you are touching someone who is touching it. In that way, they work like a magnet. And everyone knows that if you pick up a pin with a magnet, any other pin which is touching the first pin will come too. Now that you saw her in the wood, Queen Jadis looked different. She was much paler than she had been, so pale that hardly any of her beauty was left. And she was stooped, and seemed to be finding it hard to breathe, as if the air of that place stifled her. Neither of the children felt in the least afraid of her now. Let go of my hair, said Polly. What do you mean by it?
Here, let go of her hair, at once, said Diggory. They both turned and struggled with her. They were stronger than she, and in a few seconds they had forced her to let go. She reeled back, panting, and there was a look of terror in her eyes.
Quick, Diggory, said Polly, change rings and into the home pool.
Help, help, mercy, cried the witch in a faint voice, staggering after them. Take me with you. You cannot mean to leave me in this horrible place. It is killing me.
It's a reason of state, said Polly spitefully, like when you killed all those people in your own world. Do be quick, Diggory.
They had put on their green rings, but Diggory said, Oh, bother, what are we to do? He couldn't help feeling a little sorry for the Queen.
Oh, don't be such an ass, said Polly. 10 to 1, she's only shamming. Do come on.
And then both children plunged into the home pool. It's a good thing we made that mark, thought Polly. But as they jumped, Diggory felt that a large, cold finger and thumb had caught him by the ear, and as they sank down and the confused shapes of our own world began to appear, the grip of that finger and thumb grew stronger. The witch was apparently recovering her strength. Diggory struggled and kicked, but it was not of the least use. In a moment they found themselves in Uncle Andrew's study, and there was Uncle Andrew himself staring at the wonderful creature that Diggory had brought back from beyond the world. And well he might stare. Diggory and Polly stared too. There was no doubt that the witch had got over her faintness, and now that one saw her in our own world, with ordinary things around her, she fairly took one's breath away. In Charn she had been alarming enough. In London she was terrifying. For one thing, they had not realized till now how very big she was. Hardly human was what Diggory thought when he looked at her, and he may have been right,
for some say there is giantish blood in the royal family of Charn. But even her height was nothing compared with her beauty, her fierceness, and her wildness. She looked 10 times more alive than most of the people one meets in London. Uncle Andrew was bowing and rubbing his hands and looking, to tell the truth, extremely frightened. He seemed a little shrimp of a creature beside the witch. And yet, as Polly said afterwards, there was a sort of likeness between her face and his, something in the expression. It was the look that all wicked magicians have, the mark, which Jadis had said she could not find in Diggory's face. One good thing about seeing the two together was that you would never again be afraid of Uncle Andrew, any more than you'd be afraid of a worm after you'd met a rattlesnake, or afraid of a cow after you'd met a mad bull. Pooh, thought Diggory to himself. Him a magician? Not much. Now she's the real thing. Uncle Andrew kept on rubbing his hands and bowing. He was trying to say something very polite, but his mouth had gone all dry so that he could not speak. His experiment with the rings, as he called it, was turning out more successful than he liked, for though he had dabbled in magic for years, he had always left all the dangers, as far as one can, to other people. Nothing at all like this had ever happened to him before. Then Jadis spoke. Not very loud, but there was something in her voice that made the whole room quiver. "Where is the magician who has called me into this world?"
"Madam," gasped Uncle Andrew. "I am most honoured, highly gratified, a most unexpected pleasure. If only I had the opportunity of making any preparations,
"Where is the magician, fool?"
said Jadis.
I am, madam. I hope you will excuse any liberty these naughty children may have taken. I assure you there was no intention."
"You!" said the Queen in a still more terrible voice. Then in one stride she crossed the room, seized a great handful of Uncle Andrew's grey hair, and pulled his head back so that his face looked up into hers. Then she studied his face just as she had studied Diggory's face in the Palace of Charn. He blinked and licked his lips nervously all the time. At last she let him go, so suddenly that he reeled back against the wall.
"I see," she said scornfully. "You are a magician, of a sort. Stand up, dog, and don't sprawl there as if you were speaking to your equals. How do you come to know magic? You are not of royal blood, I'll swear."
"Well, not perhaps in the strict sense," stammered Uncle Andrew. "Not exactly royal, ma'am. The Ketterleys are, however, a very old family, an old Dorsetshire family, ma'am."
"Peace," said the witch. "I see what you are. You are a little piddling magician who works by rules and books. There is no real magic in your blood and heart. Your kind was made an end of in my world 1,000 years ago. But here I shall allow you to be my servant."
"I should be most happy, delighted to be of any service, a pleasure, I assure you."
"Peace! You talk far too much. Listen to your first task. I see we are in a large city. Procure for me at once a chariot, or a flying carpet, or a well-trained dragon, or whatever is usual for royal and noble persons in your land. Then bring me to places where I can get clothes and jewels and slaves fit for my rank. Tomorrow I will begin the conquest of the world."
"I'll go and order a cab at once," gasped Uncle Andrew.
"Stop," said the witch just as he reached the door.
"Do not dream of treachery. My eyes can see through walls and into the minds of men. They will be on you wherever you go. At the first sign of disobedience, I will lay such spells on you that anything you sit down on will feel like red-hot iron, and wherever you lie in a bed there will be invisible blocks of ice at your feet. Now go."
The old man went out looking like a dog with its tail between its legs.
The children were now afraid that Jadis would have something to say to them about what had happened in the wood. As it turned out, however, she never mentioned it either then or afterward. I think, and Diggory thinks too, that her mind was of a sort which cannot remember that quiet place at all, and however often you took her there and however long you left her there, she would still know nothing about it. Now that she was left alone with the children, she took no notice of either of them. And that was like her, too. In Charn she had taken no notice of Polly, till the very end, because Diggory was the one she wanted to make use of. Now that she had Uncle Andrew, she took no notice of Diggory. I expect most witches are like that. They're not interested in things or people unless they can use them. They are terribly practical. So there was silence in the room for a minute or two, but you could tell by the way Jadis tapped her foot on the floor that she was growing impatient. Presently, she said, as if to herself, "What is the old fool doing? I should have brought a whip." She stalked out of the room in pursuit of Uncle Andrew without one glance at the children. "Phew," said Polly, letting out a long breath of relief. "And now I must get home. It's frightfully late. I shall catch it." "Well, do come back as soon as you can," said Diggory. "This is simply ghastly having her here. We must make some sort of plan." "That's up to your uncle now," said Polly. "It was he who started all this messing about with magic." "All the same, you will come back, won't you? Hang it all, you can't leave me alone in a scrape like this." "I shall go home by the tunnel," said Polly, rather coldly. "That'll be the quickest way. And if you want me to come back, hadn't you better say you're sorry?"
"Sorry?" exclaimed Diggory. "Well, now, if that isn't just like a girl, what have I done?"
"Oh, nothing, of course," said Polly sarcastically. "Only nearly screwed my wrist off in that room with all the waxworks like a cowardly bully. Only struck the bell with the hammer like a silly idiot. Only turned back in the woods so that she had time to catch hold of you before we jumped into our own pool, that's all."
"Oh," said Diggory, very surprised. "Well, all right, I'll say I'm sorry, and I really am sorry about what happened in the waxworks room." "There, I've said I'm sorry. And now do be decent and come back. I shall be in a frightful hole if you don't."
"I don't see what's going to happen to you. It's Mr. Kettley who's going to sit on red-hot chairs and have ice in his bed, isn't it?"
"It isn't that sort of thing," said Diggory. "What I'm bothered about is Mother. Suppose that creature went into her room, she might frighten her to death."
"Oh, I see," said Polly in rather a different voice. "All right, we'll call it Pax. I'll come back, if I can. But I must go now." And she crawled through the little door into the tunnel, and that dark place among the rafters, which had seemed so exciting and adventurous a few hours ago, seemed quite tame and homely now. We must now go back to Uncle Andrew. His poor old heart went pitter-pat as he staggered down the attic stairs, and he kept on dabbing at his forehead with a handkerchief. When he reached his bedroom, which was on the floor below, he locked himself in. And the very first thing he did was to grope in his wardrobe for a bottle and a wine glass, which he always kept hidden there, where Auntie Letty could not find them. He poured himself out a glassful of some nasty, grown-up drink, and drank it off at one gulp. Then he drew a deep breath.
"'Pon my word,' he said to himself, "'I'm dreadfully shaken, most upsetting, and at my time of life.'
He poured out a second glass and drank it too. Then he began to change his clothes. You have never seen such clothes, but I can just remember them. He put on a very high, shiny, stiff collar of the sort that made you hold your chin up all the time. He put on a white waistcoat with a pattern on it and arranged his gold watch chain across the front. He put on his best frock coat, the one he kept for weddings and funerals. He got out his best tall hat and polished it up. There was a vase of flowers put there by Aunt Letty on his dressing table. He took one and put it in his buttonhole. He took a clean handkerchief, a lovely one such as you couldn't buy today, out of the little left-hand drawer, and put a few drops of scent on it. He took his eyeglass with a thick black ribbon and screwed it into his eye. Then he looked at himself in the mirror. Children have one kind of silliness, as you know, and grown-ups have another kind. At this moment, Uncle Andrew was beginning to be silly in a very grown-up way. Now that the witch was no longer in the same room with him, he was quickly forgetting how she had frightened him and thinking more and more of her wonderful beauty. He kept on saying to himself, "A damn fine woman, sir. A damn fine woman. A superb creature." He had also somehow managed to forget that it was the children who had got hold of this superb creature. He felt as if he himself, by his magic, had called her out of unknown worlds. "Andrew, my boy," he said to himself as he looked in the glass, "you're a devilish well-preserved fellow for your age. A distinguished-looking man, sir." You see, the foolish old man was actually beginning to imagine the witch would fall in love with him. The two drinks probably had something to do with it, and so had his best clothes, but he was in any case as vain as a peacock. That was why he had become a magician. He unlocked the door, went downstairs, sent the housemaid out to fetch a hansom, everyone had lots of servants in those days, and looked into the drawing room. There, as he expected, he found Aunt Letty. She was busily mending a mattress. It lay on the floor near the window, and she was kneeling on it.
"Ah, Letitia, my dear," said Uncle Andrew, I have to go out. Just lend me £5 or so, there's a good girl."
Girl was the way he pronounced girl.
"No, Andrew dear," said Aunt Letty in her firm, quiet voice, without looking up from her work. "I've told you times without number that I will not lend you money." "Now, pray don't be troublesome, my dear girl," said Uncle Andrew. "It's most important. You'll put me in a deucedly awkward position if you don't."
"Andrew," said Aunt Letty, looking him straight in the face,
"I wonder you are not ashamed to ask me for money."
There was a long, dull story of a grown-up kind behind these words. All you need to know about it is that Uncle Andrew, what between managing dear Letty's business matters for her, and never doing any work, and running up large bills for brandy and cigars, which Aunt Letty had paid again and again, had made her a good deal poorer than she had been 30 years ago.
"My dear girl," said Uncle Andrew, "you don't understand. I shall have some quite unexpected expenses today. I have to do a little entertaining. Come now, don't be tiresome."
"And who, pray, are you going to entertain, Andrew?" asked Aunt Letty.
A most distinguished visitor has just arrived."
"Distinguished fiddlestick," said Aunt Letty. "There hasn't been a ring at the bell for the last hour." At that moment the door was suddenly flung open. Aunt Letty looked round and saw with amazement that an enormous woman, splendidly dressed, with bare arms and flashing eyes, stood in the doorway. It was the witch. Chapter 7. What Happened at the Front Door.
"Now, slave, how long am I to wait for my chariot?" thundered the witch.
Uncle Andrew cowered away from her. Now that she was really present, all the silly thoughts he had had while looking at himself in the glass were oozing out of him. But Aunt Letty at once got up from her knees and came over to the centre of the room.
"And who is this young person, Andrew, may I ask?" said Aunt Letty in icy tones. "Distinguished foreigner, the very important person," he stammered.
"Rubbish," said Aunt Letty, and then turning to the witch, "Get out of my house this moment, you shameless hussy, or I'll send for the police." She thought the witch must be someone out of a circus, and she did not approve of bare arms.
"What woman is this?" said Jadis. "Down on your knees, minion, before I blast you!"
"No strong language in this house, if you please, young woman," said Aunt Letty. Instantly, as it seemed to Uncle Andrew, the queen towered up to an even greater height. Fire flashed from her eyes. She flung out her arm with the same gesture and the same horrible-sounding words that had lately turned the palace gates of Charn to dust. But nothing happened, except that Aunt Letty, thinking that those horrible words were meant to be English, said, "I thought as much. The woman is drunk. Drunk. She can't even speak clearly." It must have been a terrible moment for the witch when she suddenly realized that her power of turning people into dust, which had been quite real in her own world, was not going to work in ours. But she did not lose her nerve, even for a second. Without wasting a thought on her disappointment, she lunged forward, caught Aunt Letty round the neck and the knees, raised her high above her head as if she had been no heavier than a doll, and threw her across the room. While Aunt Letty was still hurtling through the air, the housemaid, who was having a beautifully exciting morning, put her head in at the door and said,
"If you please, sir, the hansom's come."
"Lead on, slave," said the witch to Uncle Andrew.
He began muttering something about
regrettable violence, must really protest,
but at a single glance from Jadis he became speechless. She drove him out of the room and out of the house, and Diggory came running down the stairs just in time to see the front door close behind them.
"Jiminy," he said, "she's loose in London, and with Uncle Andrew. I wonder what on earth is going to happen now."
"Oh, Master Diggory," said the housemaid, who was really having a wonderful day, "I think Miss Kettley's hurt herself somehow."
So they both rushed into the drawing room to find out what had happened. If Aunt Letty had fallen on bare boards or even on the carpet, I suppose all her bones would have been broken, but by great good luck she had fallen on the mattress. Aunt Letty was a very tough old lady. Aunts often were in those days. After she had had some sal volatile and sat still for a few minutes, she said there was nothing the matter with her except a few bruises. Very soon she was taking charge of the situation. "Sarah," she said to the housemaid, who had never had such a day before, "go round to the police station at once and tell them there is a dangerous lunatic at large. I will take Mrs. Kirk's lunch up myself." Mrs. Kirk was, of course, Diggory's mother. When Mother's lunch had been seen to, Diggory and Aunt Letty had their own. After that, he did some hard thinking. The problem was how to get the witch back to her own world, or at any rate out of ours, as soon as possible. Whatever happened, she must not be allowed to go rampaging about the house. Mother must not see her. And if possible, she must not be allowed to go rampaging about London either. Diggory had not been in the drawing room when she tried to blast Aunt Letty, but he had seen her blast the gates at Charn, so he knew her terrible powers, and did not know that she had lost any of them by coming into our world, and he knew she meant to conquer our world. At the present moment, as far as he could see, she might be blasting Buckingham Palace or the Houses of Parliament, and it was almost certain that quite a number of policemen had by now been reduced to little heaps of dust. And there didn't seem to be anything he could do about that. But the rings seemed to work like magnets, thought Diggory. If I can only touch her and then slip on my yellow, we shall both go into the wood between the worlds. I wonder, will she go all faint again there? Was that something the place does to her, or was it only the shock of being pulled out of her own world? But I suppose I'll have to risk that. And how am I to find the beast? I don't suppose Aunt Letty would let me go out, not unless I said where I was going. And I haven't got more than tuppence. I'd need any amount of money for buses and trams if I went looking all over London. Anyway, I haven't the faintest idea where to look. I wonder if Uncle Andrew is still with her. It seemed in the end that the only thing he could do was to wait and hope that Uncle Andrew and the witch would come back. If they did, he must rush out and get hold of the witch and put on his yellow ring before she had a chance to get into the house. This meant that he must watch the front door like a cat watching a mouse's hole. He dared not leave his post for a moment, so he went into the dining room and glued his face, as they say, to the window. It was a bow window from which you could see the steps up to the front door and see up and down the street, so that no one could reach the front door without your knowing. I wonder what Polly is doing, thought Diggory. He wondered about this a good deal as the first slow half-hour ticked on. But you need not wonder, for I'm going to tell you. She had got home late for her dinner, with her shoes and stockings very wet, and when they asked her where she had been and what on earth she'd been doing, she said she'd been out with Diggory Kirk. Under further questioning, she said she had got her feet wet in a pool of water, and that the pool was in a wood. Asked where the wood was, she said she didn't know. Asked if it was in one of the parks, she said truthfully enough that she supposed it might be a sort of park. From all of this, Polly's mother got the idea that Polly had gone off, without telling anyone, to some part of London she didn't know, and gone into a strange park and amused herself jumping into puddles. As a result, she was told that she had been very naughty indeed, and that she wouldn't be allowed to play with that Kirk boy any more, if anything of the sort ever happened again. Then she was given dinner, with all the nice parts left out, and sent to bed for 2 solid hours. It was a thing that happened to one quite often in those days. So while Diggory was staring out of the dining room window, Polly was lying in bed, and both were thinking how terribly slowly the time could go. I think myself I would rather have been in Polly's position. She had only to wait for the end of her 2 hours, but every few minutes Diggory would hear a cab or a baker's van or a butcher's boy coming round the corner and think, "Here she comes," and then find it wasn't. And in between these false alarms, for what seemed hours and hours, the clock ticked on, and one big fly, high up and far out of reach, buzzed against the window. It was one of those houses that get very quiet and dull in the afternoon, and always seem to smell of mutton. During his long watching and waiting, one small thing happened which I shall have to mention, because something important came of it later on. A lady called with some grapes for Diggory's mother. And as the dining room door was open, Diggory couldn't help overhearing Aunt Letty and the lady as they talked in the hall. "What lovely grapes," came Aunt Letty's voice. "I'm sure if anything could do her good, these would. But poor, dear little Mabel, I'm afraid it would need fruit from the land of youth to help her now. Nothing in this world will do much." Then they both lowered their voices and said a lot more that he could not hear. If he had heard that bit about the Land of Youth a few days ago, he would have thought Aunt Letty was just talking without meaning anything in particular, the way grown-ups do, and it wouldn't have interested him. He almost thought so now. But suddenly it flashed upon his mind that he now knew, even if Aunt Letty didn't, that there really were other worlds, and that he himself had been in one of them. At any rate, there might be a real Land of Youth somewhere. There might be almost anything. There might be fruit in some other world that would really cure his mother, and Well, you know how it feels if you begin hoping for something that you want desperately badly. You almost fight against the hope, because it is too good to be true. You've been disappointed so often before. That was how Diggory felt. But it was no good trying to throttle this hope. It might, really, really, it just might be true. So many odd things had happened already, and he had the magic rings. There must be worlds you could get to through every pool in the wood. He could hunt through them all, and then Mother Well again. Everything right again. He forgot all about watching for the witch. His hand was already going into the pocket where he kept the yellow ring, when all at once he heard a sound of galloping. Hello? What's that? Thought Diggory. Fire engine? I wonder what house is on fire. Great Scott, it's coming here. Why, it's her. I needn't tell you whom he meant by her. First came the hansom. There was no one in the driver's seat. On the roof, not sitting, but standing on the roof, swaying with superb balance as it came at full speed round the corner, with one wheel in the air, was Jadis, the Queen of Queens, and the Terror of Charn. Her teeth were bared, her eyes shone like fire, and her long hair streamed out behind her like a comet's tail. She was flogging the horse without mercy. Its nostrils were wide and red, and its sides were spotted with foam. It galloped madly up to the front door, missing the lamppost by an inch, and then reared up on its hind legs. The hansom crashed into the lamppost and shattered into several pieces. The witch, with a magnificent jump, had sprung clear just in time and landed on the horse's back. She settled herself astride and leaned forward, whispering things in its ear. They must have been things meant not to quiet it, but to madden it. It was on its hind legs again in a moment, and its neigh was like a scream. It was all hoofs and teeth and eyes and tossing mane. Only a splendid rider could have stayed on its back. Before Diggory had recovered his breath, a good many other things began to happen. A second hansom dashed up close behind the first. Out of it there jumped a fat man in a frock coat and a policeman. Then came a third hansom with two more policemen in it. After it came about 20 people, mostly errand boys, on bicycles, all ringing their bells and letting out cheers and catcalls. Last of all came a crowd of people on foot, all very hot with running, but obviously enjoying themselves. Windows shot up in all the houses of that street, and a housemaid or a butler appeared at every front door. They wanted to see the fun. Meanwhile, an old gentleman had begun to struggle shakily out of the ruins of the hansom. Several people rushed forward to help him. But as one pulled him one way and another, perhaps he would have got out quite as quickly on his own. Diggory guessed that the old gentleman must be Uncle Andrew. But you couldn't see his face. His tall hat had been bashed down over it. Diggory rushed out and joined the crowd.
"That's the woman! That's the woman!" cried the fat man, pointing at Jadis. "Do your duty, Constable. Hundreds and thousands of pounds worth she's taken out of my shop. Look at that rope of pearls round her neck. That's mine, and she's given me a black eye too, what's more."
"There she is, Governor," said one in the crowd, "and as lovely a black eye as I'd wish to see. Beautiful bit of work that must have been. God, ain't she strong, then?" "You ought to put a nice raw beefsteak on it, mister. That's what it wants," said a butcher's boy.
"Now then," said the most important of the policemen, "what's all this here?"
"I tell you, she—"
began the fat man, when someone else called out,
"Don't let the old cove in the cab get away. He pour up to it."
The old gentleman, who was certainly Uncle Andrew, had just succeeded in standing up and was rubbing his bruises.
"Now then," said the policeman, turning to him, "what's all this?"
"Oomph, poomph, chomph,"
came Uncle Andrew's voice from inside the hat.
"None of that now," said the policeman sternly. "You'll find this is no laughing matter. Take that hat off, see?"
This was more easily said than done. But after Uncle Andrew had struggled in vain with the hat for some time, two other policemen seized it by the brim and forced it off.
"Thank you. "Thank you," said Uncle Andrew in a faint voice. "Thank you. Dear me, I am terribly shaken. If someone could give me a small glass of brandy."
"Now, you attend to me, if you please," said the policeman, taking out a very large notebook and a very small pencil. "Are you in charge of that there young woman?" "Look out!" called several voices, and the policeman jumped a step backward just in time. The horse had aimed a kick at him, which would probably have killed him. Then the witch wheeled the horse round so that she faced the crowd, and its hind legs were on the footpath. She had a long, bright knife in her hand, and had been busily cutting the horse free from the wreck of the hansom. All this time Diggory had been trying to get into a position from which he could touch the witch. This wasn't at all easy, because on the side nearest to him there were too many people, and in order to get round to the other side he had to pass between the horse's hoofs and the railings of the area that surrounded the house, for the Kettleys' house had a basement. If you know anything about horses, and especially if you'd seen what a state that horse was in at the moment, you will realize that this was a ticklish thing to do. Diggory knew lots about horses, but he set his teeth and got ready to make a dash for it as soon as he saw a favorable moment. A red-faced man in a bowler hat had now shouldered his way to the front of the crowd.
"Oh, policeman," he said. "That's my horse what she's sitting on, same as it's my cab what she's made matchwood of."
"One at a time, please, one at a time," said the policeman.
"But there ain't no time," said the cabby. "I know that horse better than you do. It ain't an ordinary horse. His father was a hofficer's charger in the cavalry, he was, and if the young woman goes on hexciting him, there'll be murder done. Here, let me get at him."
The policeman was only too glad to have a good reason for standing further away from the horse. The cabby took a step nearer, looked up at Jadis, and said in a not unkindly voice,
"Now, missy, let me get in his head and just get you off. You're a lady, and you don't want all these roughs going for you, do you? You want to go home, have a nice cup of tea and a lay down, quiet-like. Then you'll feel ever so much better."
At the same time, he stretched out his hand toward the horse's head with the words,
"Steady, Strawberry, old boy, steady now."
Then, for the first time, the witch spoke.
"Dog!"
came her cold, clear voice, ringing loud above all the other noises.
"Dog, unhand our royal charger. We are the Empress Jadis."
Chapter 8. The Fight at the Lamppost.
"Oh, Empress, are you? We'll see about that," said a voice. Then another voice said, "Three cheers for the Empress of Kolniyatch,"
and quite a number joined in. A flush of colour came into the witch's face, and she bowed ever so slightly. But the cheers died away into roars of laughter, and she saw that they had only been making fun of her. A change came over her expression, and she changed the knife to her left hand. Then, without warning, she did a thing that was dreadful to see. Lightly, easily, as if it were the most ordinary thing in the world, she stretched up her right arm and wrenched off one of the crossbars of the lamppost. If she had lost some magical powers in our world, she had not lost her strength. She could break an iron bar as if it were a stick of barley sugar. She tossed her new weapon up in the air, caught it again, brandished it, and urged the horse forward. "Now's my chance," thought Diggory. He darted between the horse and the railings and began going forward. If only the brute would stay still for a moment, he might catch the witch's heel. As he rushed, he heard a sickening crash and a thud. The witch had brought the bar down on the chief policeman's helmet. The man fell like a ninepin.
"Quick, Diggory, this must be stopped," said a voice beside him. It was Polly, who had rushed down the moment she was allowed out of bed.
"You are a brick," said Diggory. "Hold on to me tight. You'll have to manage the ring. Yellow, remember, and don't put it on till I shout." There was a second crash, and another policeman crumpled up. Then came an angry roar from the crowd.
"Pull her down! Get a few paving stones! Call out the military!"
But most of them were getting as far away as they could. The cabby, however, obviously the bravest as well as the kindest person present, was keeping close to the horse, dodging this way and that to avoid the bar, but still trying to catch Strawberry's head. The crowd booed and bellowed again. A stone whistled over Diggory's head. Then came the voice of the witch, clear like a great bell and sounding as if for once she were almost happy.
Come, you shall pay dearly for this when I have conquered your world. Not one stone of your city will be left. I will make it as Charn, as Philinda, as Sorlois, as Bramandin.
Diggory at last caught her ankle. She kicked back with her heel and hit him in the mouth. In his pain he lost hold. His lip was cut and his mouth full of blood. From somewhere very close by came the voice of Uncle Andrew in a sort of trembling scream.
"Madam, my dear young lady, for heaven's sake, compose yourself!"
Diggory made a second grab at her heel and was again shaken off. More men were knocked down by the iron bar. He made a third grab, caught the heel, held on like grim death, shouting to Polly, "Go!" Then, oh, thank goodness, the angry, frightened faces had vanished. The angry, frightened voices were silenced, all except Uncle Andrew's. Close beside Diggory in the darkness, it was wailing on.
"Oh, oh, is this delirium? Is it the end? I can't bear it. It's not fair. I never meant to be a magician. It's all a misunderstanding. It's all my godmother's fault. I must protest against this, in my state of health, too. Very old Dorsetshire family."
Bother, thought Diggory. We didn't want to bring him along. My hat, what a picnic. Are you there, Polly?
Yes, I'm here. Don't keep on shoving.
I'm not, began Diggory. But before he could say anything more, their heads came out into the warm green sunshine of the wood. And as they stepped out of the pool, Polly cried out,
"Oh, look! We've brought the old horse with us, too, and Mr. Ketterly, and the cabby. This is a pretty kettle of fish."
As soon as the witch saw that she was once more in the wood, she turned pale and bent down till her face touched the mane of the horse. You could see she felt deadly sick. Uncle Andrew was shivering, but Strawberry, the horse, shook his head, gave a cheerful whinny, and seemed to feel better. He became quiet for the first time since Diggory had seen him. His ears, which had been laid flat back on his skull, came into their proper position, and the fire went out of his eyes.
"That's right, old boy," said the cabby, clapping Strawberry's neck. "That's better. Take it easy."
Strawberry did the most natural thing in the world. Being very thirsty, and no wonder, he walked slowly across to the nearest pool and stepped into it to have a drink. Diggory was still holding the witch's heel, and Polly was holding Diggory's hand. One of the cabby's hands was on Strawberry, and Uncle Andrew, still very shaky, had just grabbed on the cabby's other hand. "Quick," said Polly, with a look at Diggory. "Greens!" So the horse never got his drink. Instead, the whole party found themselves sinking into darkness. Strawberry neighed, Uncle Andrew whimpered. Diggory said, "That was a bit of luck." There was a short pause. Then Polly said, "Oughtn't we to be nearly there now?" "We do seem to be somewhere," said Diggory. "At least I'm standing on something solid."
"Why, so am I, now that I come to think of it," said Polly. "But why is it so dark? I say, do you think we got into the wrong pool?"
"Perhaps this is Charn," said Diggory. "Only we've got back in the middle of the night."
"This is not Charn," came the witch's voice. "This is an empty world. This is nothing."
And really it was uncommonly like nothing. There were no stars. It was so dark that they couldn't see one another at all, and it made no difference whether you kept your eyes shut or opened. Under their feet there was a cool, flat something which might have been earth, and was certainly not grass or wood. The air was cold and dry, and there was no wind.
"My doom has come upon me," said the witch in a voice of horrible calmness.
"Oh, don't say that," babbled Uncle Andrew. "My dear young lady, pray don't say such things. It can't be as bad as that. Ah, cabman, my good man, you don't happen to have a flask about you. A drop of spirits is just what I need."
Now then, came the cabby's voice, a good, firm, hardy voice. "Keep cool, everyone, that's what I say. No bones broken, anyone? Good. Well, there's something to be thankful for straight away, and more than anyone could expect after falling all that way. Now, if we've fallen down some diggings, as it might be for a new station on the underground, someone will come and get us out presently, see? And if we're dead, which I don't deny it might be, well, you've got to remember that worse things happen at sea, and a chap's got to die sometime, and there ain't nothing to be afraid of if a chap's led a decent life. And if you ask me, I think the best thing we could do to pass the time would be to sing a hymn."
And he did.
He struck up at once a harvest Thanksgiving hymn, all about crops being safely gathered in. It was not very suitable to a place which felt as if nothing had ever grown there since the beginning of time, but it was the one he could remember best. He had a fine voice, and the children joined in. It was very cheering. Uncle Andrew and the witch did not join in. Towards the end of the hymn, Diggory felt someone plucking at his elbow, and from a general smell of brandy and cigars and good clothes, he decided that it must be Uncle Andrew. Uncle Andrew was cautiously pulling him away from the others. When they'd gone a little distance, the old man put his mouth so close to Diggory's ear that it tickled and whispered,
"Now, my boy,